Senator Stedman, Wilkowski, McGuire, co-chair Newman. I think Representative Tuck will be here in a moment. Representative Edgman is probably on his way back home. He was here. Online, we have Representative Wilson, Guttenberg, Senator Thomas, Representative Seaton, and Representative Kawasaki. For those of you online, you sometimes know the difficulty, so you just have to get our attention, and we will certainly respond with questions. I want to kind of preface this meeting as this is kind of the second part of an open season update that started in April with TransCanada's update to the legislature. This is the second part of that as we have two competing projects. So we are now going to hear today from the second competing project, and that is the Denali project. And I'd like to welcome Bud Backel, president of the Denali project, and he has some people here with him that he will introduce as we go. And are there any questions from the committee before we get started? Thank you, Mr. Backel. Go ahead, please.
Well, thank you for the invitation. We're thrilled to be here this afternoon. I have brought along some of the Denali leadership team with me, who I'll introduce here in a few minutes. The idea is to try to give you a little bit deeper understanding of some of the technical and commercial work that we've done in the last 2 years. The slide I have before you, which is slide number 2 for those on the phone, is an outline of our presentation today. We've got about 45 minutes of prepared material, about 33 slides.
Do you want to go back to your desk?
Love for you to ask questions as we go along and not hold them till the end. I think we have 2 hours, but let's feel free to interrupt us as we go along.
Bud, if you can excuse me, this is David Guttenberg.
Hang on a second. Who's speaking?
This is David Guttenberg.
Oh, yes, sir?
Can we get the operator to turn up the volume?
I think we can do that. If you move the mic a little closer also.
Can you hear me now?
That's better. Thank you.
That's better. Okay, we'll move it up here close by.
And David, on your end, we can barely hear you too, so you might want to do the same thing on the other end.
Okay.
Thank you.
So if we look at the agenda, I'm going to start out with several slides, just give you an overview of the work we've been doing and kind of a summary of our commercial and technical offer. Next, we'll have Roberto Reichart, who's the Vice President for the Gas Treatment Plant, talk in a little more detail about the gas treatment plant cost estimate and the technical details behind it. And secondly, Chris Furr, who's the Vice President for the Main Line, do a similar on the Main Line. And then Scott Jepson, who's our Vice President of Business Services, will talk about the commercial offer in more detail. And then I'll wrap it up with a few slides at the end, just summarizing everything you've heard. And again, please feel free to interrupt us and ask questions as we go along.
But before you go on, we also have Bob Holly with Denali that's listening in, because I don't think we're on gavel to gavel, so he's listening in as well. But I think he's just here to listen, but so that everyone knows who we're talking to and about.
Great. Bob is our technical and HSE vice president, so if we have any difficult questions, we'll ask him to pipe in.
It's always good to have that phone a friend option, isn't it?
That's right.
Go ahead.
So Denali's open season plan was approved by FERC. We will start our open season here in just a few weeks on July 6th, and we'll complete the open season on October 4th. So that's the 90-day actual open season period. Prior to this, we've had a 90-day period where we had our open season plan in the public and received comments, and then FERC took those under comments and approved it. During open season, we will be seeking binding agreements to move a pipeline forward, particularly one of this size. We need firm transportation commitments, and that starts with precedent agreements being signed during the open season.
Yeah, before you go on, for the people online, if you'd identify when you go to the next slide,
okay,
it'll be easier for them to keep up. I'd also like to recognize Bill Nolan, the audience, former commissioner of Economic Development here, and I think that covered. I see Joe Bayless trying to hide back there, but it's not working. Welcome. And with that, Representative Newman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But you just mentioned binding open season. Could you expand on, you know, it's an industry terms that are used in that, whether binding or non-binding. you know, whether there's commitments or non-commitments, you know, to do things in open season. I know that Senator McGuire and Wilkowski and my co-chair were in San Diego last year listening to Sempra Energy talk about open season 101, and they went into binding or non-binding, and they said, you know, that gentleman from Sempra basically said, we call non-binding as non-committal, or, you know, that the value of them was different than what was considered a binding open season. You kind of, in industry jargon, explain the differences or a binding or how that works?
Representative Newman, through the chair, the two terms do have a specific meaning. A non-binding open season is where you actually just go out and solicit interest in a pipeline or at any other project. You're not asking people to commit to that. It's almost like an interest survey. A binding open season is where you actually go out and you try to get signatures that bind both parties, the transporter, ourselves, and the shippers, to an agreement. Now, that agreement at this stage will have conditions precedent. So during the 90-day period of time, what we're really working on is to identify those conditions precedent by the transporter and the shipper. We've already identified our conditions precedent in the offer that we put out during the open season plan. So as we go through the open season, we'll find out what are the conditions precedent with the shippers if they decide to sign something. The process after that is then, as you set up time frame, to resolve those conditions precedent so that you actually end up having a binding agreement. You then sign what's called a firm transportation service agreement out of that. So it's a progress that moves along in kind of a pragmatic fashion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So we believe, if you go to slide 3, that we have a high-quality design and project execution plan, and this is underpinned by a number of things. First of all, we've spent over $140 million in the last 2 years putting a cost estimate together, building the technical pieces of the plan. In addition, we've consumed over 670,000 man-hours. So you can see that the 1,000 pages of documents that we actually filed with FERC has quite a bit behind it, and we'll talk a lot about that today. We think it's a high-quality estimate because we bring decades of Arctic and mega project experience to this pipeline. We also have engaged world-class engineering firms, Bechtel on the pipeline side, Fluor Worley Parsons and CH2M Hill support the GTP and the pipeline itself. We've also had the advantage of gathering field data during this two-year period of time. We've had previous field data. We've added our own field data to that. And lastly, there have been hundreds of millions of dollars spent on previous studies over the last 30 years. We've incorporated all of that into our design. So in the end, we're very confident that we have a high-quality design. And that's important because one of the things we're trying to do is convince shippers that we know what the cost of the pipeline is today and then what the risks and uncertainties are of that pipeline. This is an enormous undertaking. Let's not kid anyone. It has significant risks. One of the things we've tried to do in our commercial offering is address those risks so we're not asking shippers to take unreasonable risks too early in the life of the project, and we'll talk a bit about that as we move along. I'm going to move to slide 4 now. So, a high-level description of the project. The project is designed for 4.5 billion cubic feet of gas a day that moves from the North Slope of Alaska to North America. We're planning on having 6 delivery or offtake points in Alaska and 4 in Canada. It starts with a very large gas treatment plant to remove CO2 and impurities on the North Slope, compress and chill the gas. The gas treatment plant itself actually has unbundled services, so you can choose a number of services or not choose them when you process the gas. Our offer also includes transmission lines from Prudhoe Bay to the gas treatment plant, which is quite short, and then from Point Thompson to the gas treatment plant. Again, shippers can decide whether they want to sign on for those transmission lines or build them themselves. And then finally, a main line that goes from Prudhoe Bay to Delta Junction down the Taps Highway right away, then through the Yukon and British Columbia into western Alberta. The Alaska portion, as you can see, is over 700 miles long. The Canadian portion is over 1,000 miles long. The last thing that we offer, there are actually three offtake points in Alberta to feed gas to the U.S., the Spectra system to the northwest, the Nova system, and then the Alliance system to the middle part of the country. Our offer allows shippers to nominate gas on any three of those options.
But, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, is that Representative Wilson?
Yes, it is. I was just wondering, is there, you said that there were six delivery points in Alaska, and I'm just wondering, do you know yet where they are?
Through the chair. Yes, we do. There is actually an in-state gas study that was completed, and we've used that in-state gas study, and they've identified the locations of those points inside Alaska. Don't remember them all off the top of my head. You know, Fairbanks is obviously one, Delta Junction, Living Good. There are five of them along that route. We have a sixth one on the North Slope at GTP, where if the operators on the North Slope chose to take sweet gas from our plant, we could deliver it to them.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Newman, you're talking about 4.5 billion cubic feet a day.
Is that Johnson or
TransCanada? I believe we're going towards a 48-inch line, which carries 5.5 billion cubic feet a day at maximum, which would allow, again, they need a 4.5 billion a day to amortize their expenditures on a pipeline, which will leave up to a billion a day for in-state use for either gas liquids or petrochemical expansion of Nikiski, whatever the case may be, to make sure that we can provide for Alaska's needs. What size of pipe are you thinking about on that?
Through the chair, this is a 48-inch pipe, which is expandable to around the same ranges that you're talking about there.
Well, before we move on, I have some questions. And also, Representative Tuck has joined us online. You said that you'd have that the producers would have a selection of services. Did I hear that right? At the gas treatment plant. Do you treat the gas differently? Can you kind of go into that a little bit? What does that mean when they have a selection of services?
Part of the FERC process requires a pipeline company to offer what's called unbundled services. So we can't bundle them all up for one tariff. At GTP, we're offering gas treating services, so removing CO2 and H2S, and then compression and chilling services. A company could choose, for instance, if you have sweet gas and all you want to do is bring it in and compress the gas, you could choose to bypass the gas treating portion of the plant. Or you could, if you have gas that has CO2 in Prudhoe Bay, you'd have to choose to elect to use both of those services.
But what would that do to the tariff if there's sweet gas, and I'm sure there is sweet gas up there, what does that do to the tariff if someone has sweet gas? Is that better profits? What does that translate to if you can bypass the gas treatment plant, and how does that affect the tariff for everyone as it goes down the line?
That would reduce the tariff if you didn't choose to process it and you have sweet gas. And we'll show you some tariffs here in a few minutes.
That would reduce the tariff for the company that had the sweet gas.
That's right.
If it needed processing, would that increase their tariff? So you still have to pay for that gas.
The gas is processed on a BTU value. The tariffs are based on a BTU value. So you come in and measure the BTU value, which excludes the sour gas that you have in there.
So I want to make sure I understand it. So the producer that finds the sweet gas is going to pay a lower tariff than someone who has, for lack of a better term, a dirtier product.
That's correct, because they wouldn't need to do gas treating to remove it.
And that is a FERC requirement we can't do.
Unbundled services are a FERC requirement.
Thank you, sir.
So let's move to slide number five. These are some of the key metrics on the commercial offer. And I just want to highlight at the top of the slide, these are all in a 2009 U.S. dollar estimates. So it's essentially dollars of the day today. We have what's called a high-quality class 4 cost estimate, and our estimate is $35 billion. That includes the gas treatment plant and both the Canadian and Alaskan portions of the pipeline. We're calling it high-quality class 4 because we've not only met every requirement under a class 4 estimate, we've met almost all of class 3. But we can't check off that it's a class 3 estimate because there's still some things that need to be done there. So I think it's at this level, or at this point in time of the project, it is a high-quality cost estimate, and we feel very confident in that estimate. So the estimated tariff, then, from the GTP to Alberta is $2.67 a million BTUs. Now, that's in today's dollars. When the pipeline is built and online in 2020, that would probably be something around $3.25, just to give you a feel. Now, that will be based on what prices escalate and a number of other factors. So if we look at the summary then of the $35 billion, you can see that the GTP itself is over $12 billion. It's a mega project in itself. Its tariff, and this is all the services, would be 90 cents. The Alaska main line is $10 billion. The Canadian main line is $12.5 billion, which totals around $35 billion. If you look at the bottom of the slide, you'll see a timeline. So we're here in the middle of 2010 now. Our open season will start in early July and end in early October. We're forecasting, and this again is our success case, if all goes well, that we'll file our CPCN the end of 2014. 2 years later, we'll receive approval from FERC on the CPCN, and then we'd sanction the project in early 2016. That then delivers first gas in 2020, and we ramp up our trains on the GTP thereafter. One of our main things that we're trying to do right now is provide to the shippers a lot of confidence in the cost estimate and that we understand the project in detail. I think one of the things that underpins this is having a high-quality team. And I thought it was important for you to understand the team that we've assembled here, which I'm very proud of. I think we've got just a first-class team. We've leveraged over 30 years of historical technical work that's been done on the pipeline, so we've been able to start with that. We have a very experienced core team, decades of projects and engineering experience around the world, as well as here in Alaska, North Slope, Arctic experience, global frontier, mega projects. We also have world-class capabilities. As I mentioned, we have three world-class engineering firms working with us. In addition to a number of people on our project team have either built or operated mega projects around the world. Additionally, we have experienced and highly regarded contractors locally here in the state and in Canada, pipeline engineering, pipeline construction, geotechnical, GIS, gas plant engineering, logistics, all those pieces come together as you put together an execution plan for a project like this. Virtually every major project that's been constructed on the North Slope was built by one of our owners. And so we have the benefit of people who have worked on those projects coming into our team, as well as the processes that those two owners use. So we feel very good about the project team. And we've had a lot of conversations with shippers already, and we're getting that kind of feedback from them that they're impressed with the level of understanding and the risk that we've identified as you move forward.
Before you go on, Senator French.
Thank you. My question is about the number of people employed by your effort. How many full-time or full-time equivalent employees are working on this project, either directly for you or through your contract?
Senator French, through the chair, it varies depending on what we're doing. Probably at the peak, we had around 90 people in what we called our core team. And then we had dozens of contractors. I'll show you a slide of those. For instance, not counted in that is we had engineering offices in Long Beach, California with Fluor Worley Parsons. We had 40 to 50 people there. We had an engineering office with Bechtel in Houston and had, 15 to 20 people at any time working there. We have an office in Canada as well, and we have the core team that sits here in Anchorage. So we've had this, what I call the core team of 80 to 90 people at peak, and then dozens of contractors after that. Probably actually this, if I go to the next slide, slide 7, probably answers your question even a little better. Here's a slide showing the logos of many of the companies, not all of them, but many of the companies that have worked for us or currently are working for us. Every time I show this slide, I have some contractor that comes up and says, I want my logo on your slide because I'm doing this piece of work for you. I think the thing that's important here is we've employed either large engineering contractors or small boutique contractors who understand and have expertise in a particular part of the pipeline. What I use as an example is logistics, particularly sea lifts on the North Slope. We have a contractor who's handled almost all of the sea lifts on the North Slope over the history of the slope. So when they say we can do something, we have a high level of confidence it can be done. I think importantly, when they say it can't be done, we know it can be done.
Representative Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to confine my questions, but when you looked at we're talking about the financing, there was a kind of an $18 billion question out there on federal loan guarantees, and I didn't see that in part of this, and I believe it, and I'm just trying to compare apples to apples here. With the TransCanada proposal, I believe they recently announced that they would seek requiring a doubling of those loan guarantees from the federal government. So we'd have approximately $36 billion in loan guarantees on a $40 billion pipeline, which is 90% loan guarantees on a project. I didn't see the loan guarantees in your financial here, and I cheated and I looked ahead and didn't see them here, but that's a pretty important question. How's that play into your...
Representative Newman, through the chair, loan guarantees are going to be an important part of financing the project. We are not at the stage where we're working the finance plan to any degree. We're still trying to determine if we have a commercial venture or not, but loan guarantees are going to be important. We now know that the project's $35 billion, so an $18 billion loan guarantee is much smaller than what the project looks like today. And there are a number of bills before Congress right now on loan guarantees. Senator Murkowski has one, I believe, that's out there. Loan guarantees will be an important part of the project financing. And actually, as part of our open season plan, we have to provide a financing plan. And we did talk about that in the public documents, that we will be looking at every source of financing, including loan guarantees.
Senator Murkowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
BP just put out a press release today saying that they intend to implement a significant reduction in organic capital spending. And do you see that as impacting this project at all, or BP's participation in this project at all?
Senator Murkowski, through the chair, we have a budget that's been approved by both of our owners, and they've indicated to me that that they will support that. So we feel good about moving through open season with the budget and funding that we have today.
Go ahead.
We'll go to slide number 8. I thought you'd be interested in this slide before we start digging into some of the technical details. It's always a question, how many people are going to be involved when we're building the pipeline itself? And what we've constructed here is the manpower outlook in Alaska during the construction phase of the project. So this would be for the pipeline and the gas treatment plant. This doesn't include the manpower in Canada for the Canadian piece. So you can see that it peaks at 9,000 people during its height, but it drops off very rapidly. The other thing we've added on here, just to give you a feel, is once the pipeline's up and operating, what's the operating expense and manpower required? It's about $400 million a year. About 290 of that is in Alaska. And from a manpower standpoint, we forecast that we'll have a company of about 440 people. 310 of those will be in Alaska.
He's speaking clearly enough that it's not really an issue.
If there's no other questions for me right now, what I'd like to do is introduce Roberta Reichard. Roberta is our vice president for the gas treatment plant. And Roberta's going to spend a few minutes of time talking about the gas treatment plant and some of the technical details that they've gone through to build up the cost estimate.
Before you move on, the drop-off between 2019 and 2020, that is a huge number. And looks to me like we're going to be looking at 7,000 unemployed people for the period of a year. And I'm wondering, if those are Alaskans, we as legislators, whoever's fortunate or unfortunate enough to be here, depending on how you look at it, that's going to be a significant number to look at. Are these skills, are they transportable, or are we looking at a pipeline-only skill set? It seems to be a huge number, and I know when the oil pipeline ended, there were substantial problems caused by that lack of employment. Are you looking at that? Do you have any socioeconomic people looking at that, or is that something that we're still a number of years away from?
I think we're a number of years away from that, but I think what's important is we've now built a cost estimate and we have an execution plan. There's details behind all these numbers, so we know the kinds of crafts that are going to be involved. These are primarily pipeline related, and Christopher will talk a bit more in detail about what kind of crafts are involved here. The gas treatment plant will be less of a portion of this. This will primarily be pipeline related. So as the pipeline is completed, these jobs will go away. That was why I gave you an indication of how many people will be left to run the company afterwards. It's a different skill set. It's a different group of people. And I think it's important as we plan manpower for the state and look at how we're going to handle this, that this is recognized.
Thank you.
Roberta?
Thank you, Bud, Mr. Chairman. The GTP is a world-class treatment plant designed to condition the gas for transportation in the main line. It consists of four processing trains to remove the acid gases, such as carbon dioxide and hydrogen sulfide from the gas, to condition it for transportation. After that, the gas will be dehydrated, compressed, and chilled to 30 degrees F for input into the pipeline. As Bud mentioned, the plant is designed to output a nominal 4.5 billion cubic feet a day into the line. It would also be able to provide 300 million standard cubic feet a day of clean gas to users on the North Slope. And they can use this gas to substitute their current fuel usage. The carbon dioxide and the H2S that we remove from the gas will be returned to the shippers for their use, and for example, enhanced oil recovery, or they can sequester it. And the plant can be expanded to 5.8 billion cubic feet a day with the addition of one more treatment train. As was mentioned and discussed, the GTP services are unbundled. So a shipper would have the option to treat his gas and or compress it and chill it. And additionally, he can choose to have some of his gas returned as clean fuel gas. So moving on now to slide number 10. In the design of the plant, we have emphasized safety and the environment. And we're applying the latest inherently safer design norms from both companies. And we focus on making the plant energy efficient. The plant is highly reliable. In fact, our simulations show that we can expect the plant to be at full capacity over 98% of the time, and that's including time for plant maintenance. And in the design, we've incorporated the lessons that both our companies have learned about operating gas plants in the North Slope and other areas of other Arctic areas. Slide 11. Here's a list that shows some of the examples of some of the studies that we have completed for the gas treatment plant. And these studies encompass both design studies and project execution planning studies, such as, for example, energy optimization, constructability, logistics, and some risk analysis around the plant. These studies were then used to develop what you see on the left of the slide, the key deliverables, which are some of the engineering and planning documents, which are then used to develop the cost estimate, schedules, and execution plans. So moving on to slide 12. This is a flyover showing the 3D model of the plant. Hopefully it'll start up. There we go. This model is actually built from the individual layouts that we've done for each of the over 90 modules that composes this plant. As we fly around it, towards the bottom of the screen, you can see the flare field. Towards the top of the screen, those are the shops and maintenance, which we located well away from the plant to maintain our people from away from any dangerous areas. South of the screen is where the gas comes in and out and the compression modules. The four sort of identical modules that you see there where we're panning into, those are the four gas treating modules. We're now looking at the top of two of them. If you take the top off them, you can see inside the plant, the module, you'll see that we've actually laid out the individual key components and pieces of equipment.
Yeah, before you go on, I'm assuming that we'll have this up online for everyone who wants to look at it later.
Yes.
That'll be moving. We'll be able to have that available to anyone who wants to look at it. It is a moving document. I understand that the people online are not able to see what we're seeing now.
And it's,
but that will be available.
It's moving right now.
It's moving right now, and I'm talking over it, so go ahead.
No problems. I guess the last thing I wanted to point out, you can't see it anymore, but the large vertical vessels that were there in that model, those part of the treating plant, they're about 30 foot diameter and about 130 foot tall. So that's about the height of a 10 to a 12 story building. So this is a very large pieces of equipment. But in case you couldn't quite see the scale from that 3D model, here's a plot plan of the plant. And we've superimposed, just for scale only, some aircraft to scale. The larger aircraft that you see there, those are 747s. So this gives you an idea of the size and complexity of this plant. Moving on to slide 14. This slide outlines the sequence that we will use to fabricate, transport, and install the modules for the gas treatment plant. Our current planning basis is that the modules will be fabricated in the U.S. Gulf Coast. It's an area that has significant resources and skills for this sort of work. They do a lot of the offshore work as well. Now, and we've been at it, we performed a survey of all the major fabrication sites on the Gulf Coast, analyzed them for their capabilities and their infrastructure. And our plan calls for 5 major fabrication yards in the Gulf Coast. The first modules will be ready to sail out from the fabrication yard about 2.5 to 3 years after we receive the CPCN from FERC. They will then be loaded on ocean-going barges and transported to the North Slope. Once the modules arrive in Prudhoe Bay, they will be offloaded in the existing dock number 2, the dock will need to be upgraded and expanded so it will have a capability to berth at least four sets of barges at a time. The modules are then offloaded onto specially designed multi-axial axle vehicles to be transported to the final location where they're set on pre-installed piles. On to slide 15. The plant will require three consecutive yearly sea lifts so we can get these over 90 modules from the Gulf to the North Slope. The modules need to be in near Wainwright by late July or August of each year, or early August of each year, to take advantage of the ice-free window so they can be moved into Prudhoe Bay. That means they have to depart the Gulf Coast around mid-May to early June. Then they head south through the Panama Canal, then up the West Coast and up to Alaska. In fact, the bridges over the Panama Canal set the height limitations on the module.
Excuse me, Senator French.
Thank you. Back on slide 8, it kind of showed a big jump in employment in 2017 within 2 big years of work in 2018 and 2019. Is that jump in 2017 reflected in your statement that it's 3 years of sea lifts to construct a gas treatment plant? That is the first year of gas treatment plant construction, sort of ahead of the pipeline itself.
Yeah. Through the chair, that slide shows the manpower in Alaska, because the modules will be fabricated in the Gulf Coast. They're not shown there. However, out of the employment in Alaska, the manpower required to install the modules, the GTP modules on the North Slope, peaks at around 2,000 people. And that's in 2019.
So the remainder of that curve is the pipeline.
Is the pipeline personnel.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that. This curve is mainly dominated by the pipeline in Alaska.
And it looks to me, if I could just follow up, Mr. Chairman, it looks to me like the final year of construction is 2019 with some wrap-up in 2020. Is that roughly the idea?
Correct.
And so if you need 3 years to put your sea lift together to construct the gas treatment plant, would the first year of the sea lift for the gas treatment plant be 2017?
Actually, it's 2019.
Is the first year of sea lift for the gas treatment plant?
Correct. So the modules arrive on the North Slope in the summer of 2019.
And the gas treatment plant is then completed in 2021?
The last train is completed in 2021. We're able to produce gas in 2020 from the first train, and then consecutively we bring up the other trains online, ramping up the plant capacity.
So the pipeline flow rate in 2020 is one-third?
It's approximately a billion cubic feet a day.
Thank you.
Senator Stedman? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe we could have them, you spent quite a bit of time over the last few years talking about the employment impacts in Alaska and gearing up for it and how we're going to position the state, so on and so forth, but maybe you could just give us just a brief synopsis on the employment impact that this would have in the Gulf states and what kind of alterations or adjustments they have to deal with down there just to handle such a large construction project to make sure they have delivery on time.
Sure. Actually, I addressed some of that in the very next slide, so if I can move on to slide 16. There's some of the key quantities for the gas treatment plant. But if we move there to the bottom bullet where you see some of the estimates for the job hours required, you note that a large majority of the job hours are around module fabrication and assembly. So there's approximately 43 million man hours required to fabricate and assemble the 90 modules for the GTP.
Could you translate, how many people is that? How many Louisiana is in, obviously going to have some difficulties over the next few years. How many people in that area is Alaska going to be employed indirectly as a result of this fabrication? What kind of impact are we going to have on their job market?
This peaks at around 5,000 full-time equivalents for direct craft. On top of that, there's several hundred sort of management and supervisory personnel.
So roughly between 5,000 and 5,500 people nationwide
potentially
will be employed as a result of our pipeline.
And again, for a limited period or of around 3 years.
Thank you. Representative Stedman?
Yeah, maybe we can.
Senator Stedman? I promoted you, I'm sorry.
Can you give us a little feel? Is this going to be much of a disruption in their normal workflow down there, or is this something that they just check the box and bring them into their five plants and whip them out for you, or
no?
Or do they have major adjustments to do to be able to handle this?
Right. So through the chair, as I mentioned, we did an extensive survey. We went and visited a dozen of the major fabrication yards in the Gulf Coast area. We assessed their manpower. We assessed their projected capacities and work. Of course, that can change dramatically over the next 5 years. And we assessed that we will be using about a third of the total capacity of the Gulf Coast. So it's a significant proportion of the available capacity of the yards and manpower in the Gulf Coast.
Before you go on, where else can this be done? And I'll tell you what I'm asking the question, because we are in competition with another pipeline going through Canada. Are we going to be competing with the Canadians to build it in the same area? Do they have other places to build? If McKenzie specifically comes through, what are we going to be looking at there in terms of competition for manpower and construction space?
Again, it's hard to be sure all these years ahead of time, but we expect there will be competition not only from other pipeline projects but potentially from offshore projects. These yards that would be building these modules are also the sort of yards that build offshore platforms. That's why we made the assessment. That's why we took quite a lot of pains to try to really get a good handle of what the resources available are. And as I said, we estimate that we'll be using about a third of their capacity, which we think is reasonable. We didn't want to go much above that because yards are not going to necessarily want to dedicate all their resources, all their eggs in one basket to our project. Now, there are opportunities to build these modules outside the U.S., in the Far East, for example. However, as our base planning assumption, we're assuming that the U.S. Gulf Coast will be where we build them. However, it likely can depend on what the market is like at the time that we're going out to bid these facilities. If the Gulf Coast yards are very busy, they may not be very competitive when they bid to us, or vice versa. So there's a lot of different factors, I guess, we'll have to weigh to decide that, including things like loan guarantees. Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you kind of just hit right where I was headed with the question that, you know, the global economy trying to take advantage of every opportunity that any company can, whether it's interstate gas pipeline or this or McKinsey, whatever it is. With the global economy in a slump, the industry is hungry. You know, you can get better value on these. You can order them tomorrow and start working on them tomorrow, and there's more competition, get a better price. How do you account for that? And is that in your, you've got a class 4 engineering report, which is what, 70 to 78% complete? Is that included in that type of formulation on that, or how do you account for that?
Let me see if I can address that. What we've done is we've studied the Gulf Coast market, and particularly the Far East, to Korea, and where these type of platforms are built. We've made the assumption when we built our execution plan that we built in the Gulf Coast. But it doesn't necessarily mean they will be built in the Gulf Coast. Again, depending on what market conditions are like at that time, and we bid out the projects, they could be built in Korea or some other place, Singapore or the Gulf Coast. So we think, you know, we were concerned going into it that they would have the capacity to build these in the Gulf Coast. And I think the positive thing out of our study is, yes, they could be. if things fell in place for us. Some of this will be about getting in the queue early in the fab yards and then setting up some new fab yards ourselves. So we do play the global market in the end. They'll be built where they will be the cheapest and the manpower exists at the time you put out the bids.
Thank you. And then, you know, you just, and it's kind of a follow-up through that, is you mentioned the sea lift. You know, that's a two-month window in Alaska. And that could set a $35 billion project back a year by not making that sea lift. Well, setting that a $35 billion project back a year on any netback increases risk analysis and cost. It's just kind of interesting to try and analyze that. I don't know how you try and measure that.
Well, we try to position ourselves to take advantage of every day that we actually are ice-free and are able to get into Prince Bay. So that's why we want to be ready in Wainwright early enough, so if we have an early breakup, we could move right in. If it's a bit later, then we're waiting. But also, the amount of time that we actually require to move the sea lift in and offload it and then get the barges back out, which is also important to get them back out before the ice comes back in, is a small proportion of the average time period that we have ice free. We're looking at something about 20%. We'll require about 20% of the typical window that is available. So that's another way that we mitigate the risk.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, who is this?
This is David Guttenberg.
Representative Guttenberg, please.
Thank you. I have a question. And thank you for the presentation. Up to this point, you've been entirely focused on the gas treatment plant and the pipeline. And there's a lot of infrastructure in Prudhoe Bay and Kaparik and all the outlying fields that will have to be upgraded or modified for gas. I'm assuming that you've already done some of preliminary work on what that's going to be. And have you built those employment numbers and timelines into your numbers that we've seen so far?
Through the chair, no, we've actually looked at the facilities that Denali would be responsible for implementing. We haven't assessed what modifications potential shippers may need to do to their plants to deliver gas to us. We are in conversations with potential shippers and also have had meetings with the operators in Prudhoe Bay, and they're aware of our plans and they're aware of what they may need to do, and I am quite sure that they're already formulating their plans.
Let me just add to that through the chair. Right now we're looking at two fields being the primary source of gas for the plant, Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson. As you know, Point Thompson is under development now, so there will be facilities built there. Prudhoe Bay, they already produce a significant amount of gas that they're reinjecting. There will undoubtedly be some modifications made, but they have a very large gas recovery process going on there, and then they're reinjecting the gas. So on the surface, there's not a huge amount of infrastructure that will have to be built on that end. Down the road, there will be as other fields come online.
Senator French?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think Representative Guttenberg makes a good point, or at least it causes me to think about something that may have been in his mind, I don't know, but you know, he may have been thinking about something like the Dalton Highway and the $1 billion that it needs to have invested in it before the construction project can go forward. And, you know, it's not impossible to imagine that the state of Alaska is not in a position financially to make that kind of investment. I don't think the federal government's going to. I believe we should do that. But have you sort of thought about what happens if the state of Alaska doesn't have the money this time to invest $1 billion in a road that doesn't serve many people?
Through the chair, we actually have had a lot of conversations with the state on that issue, and I'll ask Chris Furr when he's up here to talk a bit about it. Roads, bridges, and ports are going to be important to moving pipe equipment and people up and down the pipeline route, so it's a very important piece of it, Senator, and Chris could dwell on that a bit. I would just say, in summary, we've had a continuing dialogue with the state in that regard.
Thank you.
Through the chair, if I may add, though, the way we structured the logistics, the pipeline component will really involve a lot more land logistics than the GTP. The GTP is mainly a sea lifted operation, so we're not really, at least for the GTP, requiring much upgrades. But Chris will address what the requirements for the pipeline. The last point I wanted to make on this slide is that on the North Slope, for the GTP plant installation, we require about 3.4 million man-hours, which at today's wage rates, that's probably about $1 billion of labor costs. And then finally, in summary, the GTP is a mega project on its own. It's been designed and planned by a world-class team, I think a team that is second to none in my opinion. It's a state-of-the-art design, and we estimate that it will cost $12.2 billion. That's 2009 dollars. Thank you.
Thank you, Roberto. Appreciate it. We have no other questions for Roberto. We'd like to switch over now and talk about the pipeline itself, and I'd like to introduce Mr. Chris Furr, who's the Vice President for the Main Line.
Thank you, Bud.
Before we go on, I'd like to recognize that Representative Ramirez has joined us. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. I'm actually glad to hear. I think there's a number of questions that have been raised already that are maybe a better fit for me to answer, and some of the work that my team has done that might better address some of the questions that have come up already. So I'll start on slide 18. At very high level, I'll just build a little bit on what Bud said, and I'll start with the transmission lines. The current basis of our commercial offer for the transmission lines is a conventional above-ground pipeline system for both Point Thompson as well as Prudhoe Bay. Point Thompson, we're looking at about a 62-mile line, 36-inch. It's initially sized to move a BCF of gas a day from Point Thompson to the inlet to the gas treating plant and is expandable to 1.5 BCF a day. We're apprenticing a 60-inch pipeline, roughly a mile long, as Bud indicated, that really links the gas treating plant inlet to the central gas facility that currently exists at Prudhoe. The central gas facility is currently moving between 7 and 8 BCF of gas a day on a daily basis. We have a pretty good idea on the tie-in requirements to tie the 60-inch into the CGF to supply the vast portion of that 4.5 BCF to the pipeline from Prudhoe. That's Prudhoe's contribution. For the main line, we are also premising a 48-inch pipeline. It has a maximum operating pressure of 2,500 pounds. The pressure varies between 2,500 down to 1,600 as the pressure drops between compressor stations. I'll talk about that more later. It will be a buried pipeline. It will be chilled in Alaska, which essentially means we will have refrigeration at the compressor stations that allow us to reduce the gas temperature below 32 degrees Fahrenheit, and it will remain below 32 degrees Fahrenheit as it traverses across Alaska to ensure that we do not fall any permafrost. Overall, to get to Alberta, we need 15 compressor stations to move the 4.5 BCF of gas a day. Six of those compressor stations will be located in Alaska. We absolutely premise that this pipeline system will be expandable. With the addition of 16 additional compressor stations between Prudhoe and Alberta, we can up the capacity to 5.6 BCF of gas a day, which is consistent with an additional acid gas removal train at the GTP. As Bud indicated, we're a little over 700 miles in Alaska, a little over 1,000 in Canada, and we provide three termination points primarily to existing pipeline infrastructure in Alberta. We will afford tie-ins to the Nova system, the Alliance system, and the Spectra system as offers to shippers as they so choose. Of the six delivery points that we are currently planning in Alaska, as Bud indicated and as Roberto indicated, we have one planned at Prudhoe to provide sweet fuel gas for fuel consumption on the North Slope. Then it's Livingood, it's a Parks Highway spur, it's Fairbanks, it's Tok, and it's Delta Junction. This is consistent with the recommendations that came from the in-state gas study that was provided by Northern Economics in January of 2010. And it's initially sized to provide about 338 million standard cubic feet a day, if my memory serves, to initial customers in Alaska. We have four delivery points in Canada. the three termination points I described, as well as an expectation to provide gas to Whitehorse. And then we are obviously very open-minded that if any shippers have a desire to provide gas to other clients somewhere along that right of way, we will get to evaluate that within our design.
That's a good question. Representative Ramos.
Thank you. And this is a question that I've meant to pose for some time. And the broader the answer, the better in this context. It applies for both pipes. We're all aware of the local transmission system that exists, the NSTAR 4,000 miles of transmission line, the small amount of transmission line in Fairbanks, the other systems that would be built out. What kind of a cost should communities anticipate between the takeoff point at the line and then connecting to the local transmission line, you know, the actual cost of the takeoff? You know, if we were designing a DOT project, you're going to get a highway to run by Bayshore, for instance. There would be an increment for the highway per mile, but then DOT would say, well, wait a minute, we need another $13.5 million to create the on-ramp and the off-ramp, or in this case, the off-ramp, and wouldn't do you a darn bit of good to get a highway if you didn't get the off-ramp to come down into the Bayshore neighborhood. And so we always talk at length about the takeoff point, but for a smaller, the takeoff point presumably would be the same for Anchorage as it would be for the Yukon River Bridge. And yet the user group that would benefit of the Yukon River Bridge be measured in the hundreds. The user group for Anchorage would be measured in the hundreds of thousands. If the cost is the same, the amortization cost would be uniquely different. So you just spent 2 minutes just help me kind of grasp that, because it would be true for either of the large lines that went through.
Representative Ramos, through the chair. Here in a few minutes, we'll show you what the tariff rate is to different locations. So that'll be part of the answer. So we do have a distance sensitive rate in our offer. So there's a different rate at Fairbanks than there is at Delta Junction, for instance. In addition to that, though, there will be another charge, which we don't have a number around because it's not our part of the puzzle here, which is a distribution system is going to charge something to take the gas from our pipeline into the customer itself. And remember, this gas coming in is dense phase, so it has liquids in it. So when you drop the pressure down, you're going to produce propane, essentially, and ethane out of it. So there will be a charge there. But when Scott Jepson is reviewing the commercial terms, he'll show you what those rates are at different places. So it'll answer a portion of your question.
Because I'm, Mr. Chairman, I have to go in 25 minutes, but you see my concern is that if it costs $10 million and you're dividing that over 300 customers at the Yukon River Bridge, hell, that gas pipeline might as well just go by because nobody will be able to afford the off-ramp. Whereas if you take that same $10 million cost and divide it amongst 110,000 nozzles down here in South Central, it's an extraordinarily affordable conduit to a local distribution. And it's just always been a question that I wanted to ask, because having a takeoff point is a set of language that we're familiar with, but actually connecting it to the local transmission system is different for a system that exists that can absorb an amortized cost versus a much smaller user group that might not be able to afford that cost. So I'll be curious as that comes up.
Okay.
I guess the final comment I'll make is we get into these conversations quite often as we have conversations with stakeholders and villages and towns and cities along this right-of-way. And setting expectations has been one of the challenges for our group. Representative Ramirez's observation is 100% correct. We're offering a tie-in point with gas at between 1,600 and 2,500 pounds. It is not utility-quality gas, and is not an insignificant amount of capital that will be required to reduce the pressure, reduce the liquids, and provide a safe supply by utility to an end user. That is a very true point. Let me talk a little bit about the engineering work. The first thing that I'm extremely proud of is we have spent a lot of time ensuring that the pipeline system is fully integrated with the gas treating plant. As you probably got an understanding, the treating plant is a very complex facility. And at the end of the day, we need to provide a service with a certain reliability to potential shippers. And we've done a lot of work to demonstrate that, starting with gas compositions, operating philosophies, pressure requirements, et cetera, that we are a fully integrated system that we can deliver to potential shippers. At the end of the day, with regard to the engineering of a pipeline, it all really starts with identifying the route. So we have spent extensive amounts of time in the field evaluating what we think is an optimized route, realizing that you won't finalize the route until probably the last foot of ditch is dug, to be honest. But we've leveraged a lot of the historical work that's been done by our owner companies. And at the end of the day, we have over 12,000 boreholes that have tried to identify the soil conditions along the route. What's extremely important about the route is it defines the types of soils, the slopes you need to work on, the work surfaces you have to be prepared to build to be able to move heavy equipment to lay this pipe. It describes the elevation of the pipeline at any point that affects the hydraulics. That all goes into the system design. Once you have the route identified, then you can dive into really the pipeline design. We've got our own proprietary thermal hydraulic model that we have modeled the pipeline system that identifies the number of compressor stations, the horsepower requirements, where they physically need to be located. And then we have iterated that technical work with our environmental, regulatory, and land people to ensure that we are not premising putting a compressor station in the middle of somebody's city limits or putting it in the middle of the lake or something like that. So we've tried to optimize the location of the compressor stations.
Representative Newman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you're, I'm assuming, you know, when you head your location of your route from Pruitt to Fairbanks, you're going up over, basically, I'm assuming, following the basic pipeline route, the TAPS. Where you have pinch points such as Addigan Pass, where you have limited distance from the pipes, is there going to be an issue of the explosiveness of the gas, oil, pipelines, and such?
Representative Newman, through the chair, I think there is absolutely going to be some issues with regard to pinch points, Addigan being one of the most critical ones that needs to be resolved within the state of Alaska. There are three or four more in Canada that are equally challenging. We have had some initial conversations with Alyeska. Our base approach is we will not place the pipeline right away any closer than 250 feet to the existing TAPS pipeline. There are areas where we are going to cross underneath it numerous times, but our base philosophy is trying to maintain at least that 250-foot standoff between ourselves and TAPS. And actually, we'll have a fly-through over Addigan Pass four or five slides from now, and we can take a look at that.
I'd also like to represent our let everyone know Representative Gatto has joined us. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Compressor station design. I think this speaks a little bit to the labor discussion we were having earlier. Our premise is the compressor stations will be truckable fabricated modules that we intend to build in Fairbanks, in Anchorage, in Kenai. And we are trying to maximize the amount of truckable modules for each of these compressor stations. I think the refrigerated stations in Alaska are roughly 38 to 40 truckable modules each, that then we will assemble on the compressor station sites to try and maximize local content here where the fabrication yards currently exist. And on the slide that Bud had showed with regard to the total staffing requirements, that's about 250 or 300 jobs in the fabrication yard starting in 2017 and goes to 2020. River crossings, there are some significant river crossings that need to be engineered. You throw in the Yukon River, for example, our base premise is we will horizontally directionally drill under the Yukon River. Our base case on most of the major rivers, of which there is roughly 80 major river crossings, if I recall, between Prudhoe Bay and Alberta, that obviously will do significant additional engineering as we move into our FEED phase, into final detailed engineering, but that's not an insignificant challenge. Faults, we do have active faults, as everyone here is aware. At points on the right-of-way, we parallel some of the active faults, and there are also areas where we need to cross active faults, and we'll need to do detailed engineering to ensure that the pipeline can take that kind of stress and strain in the event of a seismic event. High-strength steel. We are premising using a high-strength steel. The weldability of the steel, the ability to identify defects in the welds, all need to be finalized as we ultimately permit what is called a strain-based design for this pipeline. This pipeline does need to be able to absorb frost heave, thaw settlement, elements associated with some of the permafrost issues that we have here in Alaska, and it needs to be designed to withstand those kinds of stresses and strains. We've also developed our proprietary geospatial system. At the end of the day, we have a database system, all geospatially oriented, that contains all of the technical information for the 1,750 miles of this pipeline, from soil conditions to land ownership to borehole studies, et cetera, all essentially located in one database to facilitate the engineering.
Before you go on, this high-strength steel, is that readily available? Or you talked earlier about no one really makes the pipe, someone's going to have to gear up for it. Is the 48-inch high-strength steel readily available?
Mr. Chairman, readily available, the answer is no. There are currently seven mills globally that can make what we're calling X80. It's 80,000 PSI stress-capable pipe. The mills currently are in Europe, Japan, and India, and Russia. They can currently make it. When we went out for quotes around the pipe, we eliminated the India source, we eliminated the Russian source from our evaluation, and the current basis of our cost estimate is now focused on Japan. Clearly, they can make this pipe in Europe, and then over the next 3 or 4 years, we'll see if there are any North American mills that begin to develop that capability. My view is you can wait about 3 more years before you need to finalize who you will ultimately place these orders with the mills to get all the pre-testing and certification work done to facilitate the delivery of the pipe.
Before we go on, Mr. President, welcome. Thank you for joining us. Senator Stevens.
Okay, what I'd like to show y'all right now on...
Before you go on,
yes, sir.
Representative Gatto, I'm sorry.
Is it rolling the specific diameter, with X80? Is it possible to roll a thicker pipe without X80 and make it in North America?
Through the chair.
Local hire, local production, local manufacturing.
Currently there aren't capabilities with U.S. mills that even though it's not just the X80, the material, that is preventing a U.S. mill, for example, being able to produce this pipe. It is a combination of the specifications of the materials as well as its diameter and its wall thickness. Currently, there's just not the infrastructure in U.S. mills that are capable of doing that. Okay. On slide 20 is the alignment sheet. Essentially, this is an example which we have characterized for the entire 1,750 miles, and it's a plan view of the right-of-way, the pipeline route. And the interesting information that I just want to talk about is all of the information that sits down below that. We have described and defined on this pipeline the slopes, both longitudinal, the cross slopes. That's important when you figure out how much dirt do you have to move, how much pad or gravel do you need to move in as you build your cost estimates, what type of work pads do you need, ice, gravel, frost packing, etc. It describes the terrain, cobbles, permafrost, that ultimately says, how are you going to dig the ditch? What are you going to dig the ditch with? How fast can you dig the ditch? It all ultimately speaks to what is this going to cost to build it. I've just got a couple on slide 21, just a couple of interesting facts, and hopefully this will give you some sense of the level of definition that we have around our execution plan and the requirements or quantities that are going to need to be purchased to deliver the construction. Of the 90 mainline block valves, as an order of magnitude, that's essentially $50 million in block valves in and of itself. That's the to get from Prudhoe to Alberta. There's 2.2 million tons of X80 steel. That's roughly $4 billion worth of a capital purchase in a PO just to buy the pipeline steel. And over 20 million cubic yards of gravel that need to be mined and spread for pads, for camps, access roads, storage yards, etc. As most everyone knows, building a pipeline is a heck of a lot more than just welding some pipe together, digging a ditch, and throwing it in the ditch. What I'd like to offer to you is when we've evaluated this work, all of these different activities, we've evaluated, determined when they need to be done, what season, what crews, how many people, the equipment requirements, etc. As you begin to start building a comprehensive construction execution plan, that ultimately manifests itself in what is the cost to do this job and how long is it going to take. Then you go out and you talk to the people who do this stuff for a living. So at the end of the day, we've had over 200 requests for information from a myriad of different vendors and suppliers. I'll talk about that here briefly. And it really starts looking at, in today's environment, how fast can you weld a 48-inch pipe? How fast can you move a joint of pipe from the pipe storage yard to the right-of-way? How fast can you dig the ditch? What does labor cost? What do the project labor agreements cost in the lower 48 or Canada as you start assimilating all the inputs that ultimately you apply against the quantities of work and the activities that begin to allow you to develop a reasonable and a competent cost estimate? Slide 24, this is just a quick example. There's no way I will read this. I'm just trying to give an example. We have talked to every one of the vendors listed here to get real-time data on their areas of expertise. So at the end of the day, we've talked to the guys who have the mechanized welding machines to understand the productivity and the cost of the machines and their reliability. We've talked to the inspection contractors, people who build the trenching machines and people who dig with those trenching machines, people who bend pipe and provide the bending equipment. We've also had extensive conversations with big inch pipeline contractors, both union and non-union in the U.S., as well as major civil contractors. This is a huge civil job to move the amount of gravel and earth and equipment that needs to be moved to facilitate construction of the pipeline.
Mr. Ramirez?
Thank you. Question for you, Bud. I don't know if this question was posed before I came to the room, and I apologize if it was. Bud, this morning or during the day today, one of your owners suspended its $10 billion dividend for the year 2010. And as you go through these mainline cost estimates and you consider the equity portion for the owners of Denali, where are we in configuring that into a project that has a start time that's some years away, but putting the capital formation together for that project is certainly happens now in the planning stages. How does the effect of what's going on to the cash flow for one of your owners affect your cost estimate and stability to get? Well, obviously, it doesn't affect cost estimate, but the ability to put capital together and to tie up vendors.
Representative Ramos, through the chair, we did have that question earlier. Right now, we're at the open season stage of the project. We have full funding from both our owners, and the immediate thing is get through open season and see if we have bids on the project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we were to see the federal government institute a cap and trade program, would that issue and the removal of CO2 and other things from the gas increase the cost of construction?
Representative Gatto, through the chair, as we've looked at emissions on the slope, we've tried to take an approach that some sort of trading will take place. Remember, what we're going to be doing is taking CO2 out of the gas and reinjecting it, so that's really positive. We'll be looking at highly efficient turbines and machinery on the slope. Everything we're going to be putting in will be more efficient than what's on the slope, so the emissions will be reduced. The other thing that we've looked at that we mentioned previously is we are offering 300 million cubic feet a day of clean gas to those operators on the slope. If they chose to take that, they actually would be reducing their CO2 footprint on the slope. So I think we're doing some things with this project that you could view as being environmentally friendly.
And I know that's our thoughts. I just wondered what the thoughts are in Washington, D.C. of what's friendly. For them, it's an ability to raise taxable income or taxes. And if there are certain taxes because of just handling CO2, whatever you do with it, that there's a certain concern among some people that I don't think it's a deal breaker, but it does have to affect the cost of construction.
Through the chair, there are a number of different environmental pieces of legislation that are being discussed. So it's hard to tell what's actually going to be approved in the end. We're trying to, be aware of those, and we realize they will have an impact on us. I think, though, from a larger perspective, the administration has said that gas they view as a clean burning fuel. It's a bridging fuel to renewables.
They've said the Alaska Gas Project is in their top of their energy list. So we've had pretty positive comments from that side environmentally. We don't know what the legislation will be, and we'll have to see what impact it has on our project. It could have an impact in the end.
Okay, slide 25, and I won't belabor this as well, is just a continuing example of all of the service providers that we have inquired to get real-time data on areas or activities that are critically important to the delivery of the construction of the pipeline, and we've done it both on the U.S. side and the Canadian side. To answer a question that came up a little bit earlier on with regard to resourcing of the pipeline crafts, at the end of the day, our execution plan has seven major pipeline spreads to affect the construction over a two-year period. We plan to become mechanically complete with the pipeline in 2019. Of those seven spreads, three are in Alaska, four are in Canada. Of the, when you survey big inch qualified pipeline contractors in both the U.S. and Canada, there's essentially 23 that are pre-qualified through our initial evaluation, of which Denali would require seven. And then finally, on the material side, when you look at the mainline pipe, those are the folks we talked to get the quote as a basis of our current estimate. And then going on down the line, the major compressor packages for the pipeline itself, the generator systems, the vessels, piping, SCADA, metering, et cetera. We touch base to get quotes from all those folks as we begin to build the estimate. Okay, but this is a, and I apologize to the chair, this is also another animated, hopefully it'll work, 60-second video for the folks that are on the phone. And all this is a Google Earth application that we have built for the entire line from Brito to Alberta. What it's meant to describe, as you look at it, is the relationship of the Denali pipeline. Here, this is a rendition of a flyover from Attigan, over Attigan Pass. We'll start north at Galbraith Lake and go south over the pass. The purple line is the current representation of the right-of-way for the Denali pipeline. The green line is the existing TAPS pipeline. The brown line is the existing Dalton Highway. And as I start the animation and we start flying, you'll see things like that blue line that sits on the top. That is essentially an ice access road that we will need to be able to build. I might try that again in a minute. You'll also see brown squares, which are material sites, which we've identified we need for gravel pads, for camps, storage areas, laydowns. You should see the compressor station that sits at, on that particular section of pipeline, and you can see the approach as both TAPS and Denali get closer as you fly over the as you fly over the pass. And I'm very hopeful this will move. My apologies. Okay. Here we are. Yeah, I'm not going to stop it. So there's the blue access road. You can see where we've crossed over between Denali and the TAPS pipeline. You can see that there's compressor station 3 that we just flew by. And then as this approach gets narrow, as the representative indicated earlier, we're trying to maintain that minimum of 250 feet of separation as we begin to move up there. It does get narrow in a couple of particular areas, and we'll have to work very closely with both Alyeska pipeline and then as we go over the pass, drop down on the south side, head for the Chandelier Shelf, which you can see right now, as we drop off it and head for the Dietrich River Valley. My point being is essentially we have this representation for the entire route. It's been very helpful and very powerful when we've had conversations with some of the regulatory agencies and some of the stakeholders along the right-of-way to help describe what ultimately is going to happen, where is it going to be, what's the topography, and what are some of the infrastructure requirements that we foresee. Slide 28 to wrap this up. From the pipeline side, we feel very good about the estimate. At the end of the day, this is not a factored estimate.
Slide 28.
We have it resource loaded. We know the number of people. We know the amount of equipment. We know how long it needs to be employed, and we know the activities that need to be executed. It's quantity based. We have a mile by mile design of the pipeline. We've gone out to current industry, and we have industry benchmarks, real-time data on productivity, labor rates, those types of things to be able to populate our estimate. And we've had a world-class team of folks who do this kind of work for a living, managing major projects, yeah, delivering big pipelines all over the world to help us put this estimate together, which we feel good at about $23 billion right now for the pipeline itself.
Okay.
Thank you, Chris.
Yeah, here we go, $23 billion.
We're going to shift gears here now and talk about the commercial piece of the project, but I hope from the review that Roberto and Chris have given you, you can see why we feel confident that we understand the pipeline and the risk associated with it, and that was one of our goals, was to be able to describe that to shippers so that they feel like we understand what the cost is, and Denali understands where the risk is in the schedule and in the execution plan. So with that, I'd like to switch gears now and introduce Scott Jeffson. Scott is our Vice President for Business Services, and Scott's going to spend some time talking about the commercial offer in a little more detail.
Thank you, Bud. I want to just reiterate some of the things that Bud mentioned at the beginning, just to kind of bring things to closure here. As Bud mentioned at the beginning, our cost estimate for this project for the GTP and main lines is $35 billion, and again, that's in constant 2009 dollars. All the numbers I'm going to talk about are all going to be in constant 2009 dollars. The first table on here summarizes the cost breakdown, capital cost breakdown for the various components of the project, and the second line, of course, summarizes the cost to either move it through the GTP or to transport the gas through the main line. I want to talk a little bit about our services that we're offering. As has been mentioned several times, we are offering unbundled services. That means our customers can select only those services that they require. Specifically, we're offering offering transmission services. The transmission line from Prudhoe Bay to the GTP, we estimate, would cost a shipper about 0.4 cents per MMBTU to move gas through that system. Again, it's a very short line. We estimate about 26 cents per MMBTU to move gas from Point Thompson to the GTP. At the GTP, as Roberto mentioned, we have unbundled our services. A customer has the option of selecting either just gas treating or compression and chilling or both services. And that table on the bottom there, left side, shows the individual rates for either just treating your gas or compressing and chilling. We're also basing our rates on distance. We have distance-sensitive rates. And the table on the bottom right shows the estimated cost to move gas to a couple of delivery points inside Alaska. We're estimating about 50 cents per MMBTU to move gas to Fairbanks and about 59 cents to move it to Delta Junction. Now, if you need to treat your gas before it comes into the pipeline and is delivered at those particular points, you, of course, would have to pay the appropriate gas treatment plant costs as well. So if you required all of the services of the gas treatment plant, you'd add about 90 cents to those delivery rates.
Is it possible to send gas down the line that isn't chilled?
No, the gas will have to be chilled.
So I thought that was an option that you had up there, choose from the menu? Or?
Yeah, compression and chilling is an option. If a shipper, a customer, wants to deliver cold gas to us at 2,500 PSI, and it's sweet gas, it doesn't have any impurities in it such that it meets our pipeline spec, they can bypass the entire GTP. But that'll be a customer option. If they think that's a better option for them than paying us to treat the gas, compress it, and chill it, so be it. That's fine. I think, as Bud mentioned earlier, one of the things that the FERC required is that you not bundle the entire project into one tariff, into one rate. We have to offer individual services and options for shippers. Let me move on to my next slide.
I see Carl's wheels turning. I didn't know if he was done.
Well, thank you. It's all mixed, isn't it? If it isn't chilled and you start thawing the permafrost, isn't that the whole point behind requiring chilling?
No, a shipper would have to provide cold gas to us. They would have to chill it themselves. Otherwise, we would not accept the gas.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative
Zimmer. So if I look at this, the numbers on page 29, if treating is 67 cents, compression is 23, and delivered to Fairbanks is 50 cents, we're at $1.30. And then that includes the price of, then it would just, but above that would be purchasing of the gas, or how does that work? If I was to look at that, how would I estimate the delivered cost to Anchorage or to Fairbanks?
Okay, what we're providing is a delivery service, gas treating, compression, and then transportation. The actual selling price of the gas would be between the owner of the gas and the purchaser of the gas. We don't own the gas. We don't sell the gas. So that's a question that I can't answer right now. It really all depends upon what the market demands at that point in time.
It's like a dollar, according to your numbers, $1.40 to Fairbanks, and then whatever it costs to purchase the gas.
Through the chair, that's correct. Well, typically, through the chair, that $1.40 is going to be encompassed in whatever price the end seller sells gas for.
Through the chair, if you think of it, we're going to charge the shipper of the gas, the producer, $1.40 to get gas to Fairbanks. They're then going to charge some price to the consumer, and they will take into account taxes and profit and those things on the other end that they'll add on to that. So it would be the tariff to move the gas is $1.40, and then you're going to have taxes and development costs and profit built into that that they will charge the consumer.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Paul Seaton. And Homer, on page 29 there, where we're talking about the estimated rate at $2.67 per MMBTU, excluding fuel. Is there an excluding fuel condition also on that delivery to Fairbanks? And could you tell us approximately what that, how that excluding or how the fuel cost is handled?
Yes, the deliveries to Fairbanks exclude fuel as well, through the chair. And basically the shipper, the customer, supplies fuel in kind for transporting their gas.
I guess, so if we're looking at then the full load, $2.67, do you have any estimation of what fuel cost would be on that?
If, through the chair, if I recall correctly, I think we're about a little over 6.5% fuel, looking to Chris here. Is that about right, Chris? About 6.5% of the gross volume is fuel gas. So the prospective shipper would obviously incorporate that in whatever their selling price for that gas might be.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. May I ask another question?
Sure, go ahead.
Sure, and that really talks about that fuel gas at 6.5%. We were looking, when we were talking about the other pipeline project there, there's a condition that they let us know how they're going to handle their compression and transmission CO2 output, because that 6.5% turns out to be more than the total of all current CO2 from all commercial and residential uses in the state of Alaska. So do you have anything where you are also going to be having a plan for minimizing and handling that those CO2 emissions?
Through the chair, as I recall what Chris and Roberto explained through their presentations, the approach that we're taking is to build as efficient a compression project or plant as we can at both the GTP and all the compressor stations. That in turn will minimize our CO2 emissions. Now, with regard to CO2 that we scrub from the gas at the GTP, that will be returned to our customers, and the customers will be handling that gas presumably through reinjection.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm moving on to slide 30. I want to talk a few minutes about some of the details of our commercial offer. We believe that we have crafted a distinctive commercial offer. We have crafted something that will allow a broad group to participate as foundation shippers. Now, what's important about foundation shippers is that's the group that makes the early commitments, the long-term commitments that allows the pipeline to move forward. They take a lot of the risk, but they also have certain benefits. So I'm going to talk for a few minutes about what it takes to qualify as a foundation shipper, and then also a little bit about the benefits. In order to be a foundation shipper, first you have to meet our creditworthiness standards. That requires a credit rating of BBB by Standard & Poor's or Baa2 by Moody's. And you also have to meet our net worth requirements. The net worth requirements are such that you have a net worth that's commensurate with your commitment to the project.
You also have to execute a precedent agreement during our initial open season with a minimum term of 20 years. We do not have a minimum volume requirement. So in our estimation, these particular conditions for being a foundation shipper will make it possible for smaller leaseholders, the state, explorers, and users to potentially participate in our open season as a foundation shipper. Now, there are benefits. A foundation shipper has the option to extend their primary term 5 years. They have access to negotiated levelized rates or recourse rates. Now, negotiated levelized rates are going to be offered at several hundred basis points below the return on equity that we estimate for the recourse rates. Also, the levelized bid portion of this means that our rates for moving the gas and moving it through the GTP will essentially be constant over the term of the commitment. We also have a most favored nation clause. What this does is it ensures that our customers will have access to the lowest rates that we offer. And then lastly, we recognize that this project has a lot of uncertainty. We're going to be offering decision points to our customers at several specific points in time during the early stages of this project. We're going to be offering a decision point when we file for a certificate of public convenience and necessity, and then later when we have approvals from the U.S. and Canadian governments to move ahead with construction. We think this is going to be critical. This project has a lot of uncertainty, a lot of risk, and we think it's going to be necessary to offer these sorts of decision points in order to attract customers during our open season. Denali itself will be taking some risk. We are going to be taking our depreciation over 25 years, but we're only seeking commitments for about 20 years. That means we're going to be assuming that we can recover the remaining 20% of our depreciation over the end of the life of the project. We've also constructed our commercial offer such that it's responsive to shipper concerns. If in the event that we have an expansion down the road, subject to FERC regulations and NEB regulations, we are not going to require that existing shippers subsidize expansion shippers. Many of our customers have testified that that's a big issue for them, and so we have incorporated that in our terms and conditions of our commercial offer. In addition, if during our initial open season we don't receive commitments for at least 85% of our design capacity, we set up a framework such that we can work with our customers to either look at a redesign project for a smaller volume of gas to Alberta, look at building a pipeline to an LNG plant at a location of their choice, or if they're interested in doing it, we can work with our customers to try to garner additional support so the original project could move ahead.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Yes, I was curious, does that mean that Denali will not utilize rolled-in tariffs?
Through the chair, we will use in rolled-in rates to the extent allowed by FERC and the NEB, but we will not argue that rolled-in rates should require that existing shippers subsidize expansion shippers. I think in most likelihood, the initial expansions would probably result in a reduced rate for all shippers, but if it got to the point where the inverse was true, that is not something that we would argue. At the end of the day, it's going to be up to the FERC and the NEB in Canada as to what they're going to allow.
Thank you.
Moving on to my next slide, I want to talk just a few minutes about the open season. As Bud mentioned, we are very close to starting our open season. We intend to start at July 6th and we'll run through October 4th. During that time frame, we'll be offering open access to capacity on the pipeline. We'll be talking to customers about signing binding precedent agreements so we can move forward with the project. In the U.S., of course, the project will be overseen, the open season will be overseen by the FERC, and it will be regulated by or overseen by the NEB in Canada. We will have a simultaneous open season in Canada. As I think everybody recognizes, in the U.S., that's going to be a separate piece of business, and we will have an open season, which will be starting here shortly. We will start our Canadian open season at the same time and conclude it at the same time. We've done a fair amount of work preparing for that. We've sent out an expression of interest in January this last year to potential leaseholders, producers, and governments in Canada to elicit whatever kind of interest they might have. And we've just recently sent out another letter to all of them. It's like 250 letters or so that we've sent out announcing that we will be holding our open season in early July. As you notice at the back end of this, we have a somewhat undefined length of time, which we're identifying as about 170 days on this particular slide. What that represents is that at the end of open season, we anticipate that we will have conditions precedent or conditions to our precedent agreements that we will have to resolve with our customers. So we've provided a block of time in there to try to resolve those conditions precedents to our satisfaction and their satisfaction, such that we have an agreement on what they are so we can move forward with the project. And then, of course, once those precedent agreements are executed, we will file those with the FERC and begin moving forward with the project. If there are no more questions, I'll turn it back to Bud to conclude the presentation.
Not quite so fast. There's certain confidentiality once things are submitted to FERC. And can you explain that and what kind of availability we as a body or as a government would have to that information? Can you go into, is that a hard and fast rule that only the pipeline companies, can you waive that rule and make that public? Can TC waive that rule and make those condition bids public?
First of all, we just talk about what has to be reported. And in that first 10-day period, you have to talk basically about name, rank, and serial number, that you've got a contract, so-and-so is for X amount of gas, but you don't have to reveal the details of your commercial arrangement. That will be kept confidential unless, of course, both parties agree to release it. That can always be done with any confidential agreement.
And both parties being the pipeline and the shipper, and FERC doesn't care?
I don't think FERC would care if the customer and the transporter decided that they wanted to make that public.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, Representative Seaton?
Thank you. When Bud started the presentation, he mentioned that Denali had their conditions precedent incorporated in the RFP, and I see this 20 years, and I guess it's not using rolled-in rates if it would result in any higher tariffs. And I guess I'm wondering if there is a listing of the Denali's conditions precedents, especially those that would, you know, involve either the state of Alaska with the impact on their relationship with the pipeline or with the producers.
Through the chair, the main conditions precedents that we have are some of the ones you've talked about. In addition, things like, you know, getting approval from our owners. The conditions precedent relative to the state and resource base and so forth, we anticipate will be from the shipper side or the customer side. From our side, you know, that's not a condition precedent that we're putting down. We will ask the shippers to commit to these agreements, and they will most likely have some heavy conditions relative to that. So in our, I don't remember all of them off the top of my head. We can certainly get that to you. But when we put forward open season package, our condition precedents are out there.
I think, Mr. Chairman, it would be helpful for us to get those as kind of just a bullet points to understand. So I guess the only one that I'm hearing, in addition to the 20-year term and the rate portion, is the getting approval from the owners. Is that basically, can you think of any others there that would impact the state's relationship with the producers or the pipeline?
Through the chair, we can send you the section of our precedent agreement which lists those. They're all listed out there, and actually you can find them on our website if you download it from there, but we can also provide it to you. Most of our conditions precedent don't really relate to our relationship with the state. As Bud mentioned, the issues that would relate to the state are really shipper customer issues, and they're not transporter issues. Many of the things that we have are such as getting a CPCN. We're not going to start construction of the project till we have a CPCN. Having a CPCN in Canada, having basically the right of eminent domain through Canada to build a pipeline. It's really more construction-related, finance-related, than it is anything dealing with the relationship between the pipeline company and the state of Alaska or shippers in the state of Alaska. We'll be more than happy to provide that to you so you can have it for your reference.
If you get that to my office, we can distribute it to the members.
Okay.
Of both bodies.
Well, thank you, Scott. We're on the home stretch here. I really only have a couple more slides. What I'd like to do now is you've
you've seen our offer at a high level, and then we've drilled down on the technical piece and the commercial piece. And I'd like to go back up at, you know, 10,000 feet and just talk about the project itself. There are, I think, seven key elements for the project to be successful, to have a real project here. And let me just run through these on this slide. You have to understand the cost and be able to manage that cost and execution plan. We believe we have that under control now. We understand what that is. Obviously, that's dynamic, and you have to stay on top of it. That never ends until the project's finished. You've got to have a defined regulatory process. We feel very good about the regulatory process. We understand it here in the U.S. with FERC and with the Office of the Federal Coordinator. We've worked very diligently in Canada, and we understand the process they have there and feel like we have a handle on that item. Thirdly, you've got to offer commercial agreements to customers and get them to sign those. We have the agreements out there. We've described what they are. We think they're creative. We think they're distinctive in many fashions. The fourth item on the list is resolution of stakeholder issues up and down the pipeline route. We recognize that's still in process, particularly, I think, on the Canadian side. Getting agreements with Aboriginal groups in Canada will be an issue for the project as we move along. Attractive financing. The question came up about loan guarantees earlier. $35 billion project, you're going to have to secure financing. It's going to be a multitude of instruments most likely to do this. In order to do that, you need to have agreements and essentially collateral. So that's something the project's going to have to do down the road, is secure financing. There are a series of issues relative to the state of Alaska that are still unresolved. Resource uncertainty. Point Thompson remains in litigation. We are concerned about what shippers will do in nominating Point Thompson. Will they nominate it at all? Will they nominate it based on the issues being resolved? We don't know that. That's an issue that we encourage the parties involved to resolve, because at this juncture we feel that our open season will be heavily conditioned on that item, and that is one that's outside the realm of influence of the pipeline company itself. The second item we've talked a lot about over the last number of years is the fiscal regime for gas in the state of Alaska. We know that all the producers have testified about needing that, so we would anticipate there's going to be a condition precedent in that regard, but that's an issue that is still unresolved. And then finally, the natural gas market. I challenge anyone to tell you what the gas price will be in 2020 or 2022. What we know right now is we have a very volatile gas market in North America. Since the project was started 2 years ago, we've also seen that shale gas has come on the scene. In the end, an Alaska pipeline is going to have to compete with other sources of gas. So that means that we're going to have the lowest, you know, tariff possible, manage the costs that we talk about. We're going to have to compete with other sources of gas out there. Resolving these other issues that I mentioned are going to be extremely important in being able to build a pipeline and attract customers as we move forward down the pipeline route. So in order to have a pipeline that moves forward, you're going to have to be able to check all these seven boxes. And as a pipeline company, what we've tried to do is work on the ones that we have influence and control over. We have a high degree of confidence in those items. There's some that are outside of our control that we're relying on other parties to address. If I could just conclude with our summary then, our open season plan was approved by FERC. We will start our open season on July 6th. That was a great source of excitement for we in Denali that's been living and breathing this for 2 years. We believe we have a high quality cost estimate, and that will give shippers confidence in the cost of the project and our execution plan. I hope that you've seen why we say that now with the degree of detail we've shown you today. We also believe that we have some very attractive commercial terms that are distinctive. They also recognize the great risks that exist on this project, and we're trying to not require shippers to commit to things that it can't because of the risk associated at that point in time. The open season results are going to signal the market's assessment of Alaska's North Slope gas competitiveness. At this point, I was hoping that some of these outside influences like Point Thompson and gas fiscal regime would be resolved. We now know going into the open season, most likely they're going to be heavily conditioned on that fact. So our next steps are evaluating the open season. We are a market-driven project. Depending on what the customers say will dictate what we do after the open season. And we've essentially completed all of our technical work now for the project. We're now focused on commercial arrangements and open season to determine what shippers are going to tell us so we know what we can do next. We really appreciate your time today, and we would be happy to answer any other questions that you have. Thank you.
I have a question on FERC's, and maybe this is something that can't be answered. If I'm a senator or a representative from Louisiana, and they're asking me to increase my loan guarantees from $16 to $35 or $36 billion, one of the things I'm going to say is yes, if you build those modules in Louisiana. That may cost us more than going to another source that we discussed. Is this FERC have any allowance for that kind of increased cost to not be rolled into the tariffs? And rolled in tariffs is probably not a bad, I want to stay away from that, but included in the tariffs, if it costs an extra, I mean, we're really not talking, you know, $500 or $1 billion more to build it in Louisiana than it would in Singapore, would FERC allow us to not take that into consideration in terms of the tariff? If we can't go out and, I guess if we can't go out and go to the lowest bidder, are we going to have to pay the price for that?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I can answer that. I don't recall a case where that's been reviewed with me relative to FERC itself. I think what FERC does is a pipeline company has to come in and justify its tariff and the costs associated with it. You know, we can't forecast what other parties will do relative to loan guarantees, but I think what we've done is tried to assess the market, and right now we don't know that it will be cheaper to build it in Louisiana than it will be in Korea. What we know is we believe that physically we can build it in the Gulf Coast, and there's adequate workforce to do that, so we've used that as our base case. As we get it closer to it and we do more engineering and design work, and we go into front-end engineering design and detailed engineering design, we'll be able to better tell that. I probably haven't answered your question because I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. That's probably something you'd need to ask FERC if they would honor that or not. I mean, if they didn't honor it, then you face not, you know, moving forward with the pipeline, if that's the only place you can build it.
Representative Newman.
On that point, Mr. Chair, but what assurances do we have, or is there any assurances, or can be assurances, or what can the state of Alaska do to try and assist in making sure that as many jobs stay in Alaska as possible? So you generally, on construction, you've got a general, and then you've got subcontractors, even subs to the subs, but, you know, to make sure that we've got, Burt's construction company that's got a dump truck and an excavator and a few guys working for him can get out there and participate in construction jobs in Alaska like this. Is there an opportunity within this structure to allow for that?
Representative Newman, through the chair. I think one of the best things we can do is understand what the execution schedule looks like so we can get ahead of it. It's called front-end loading a project. I think we can do the same thing relative to the workforce. The second thing is making sure we clearly understand where the jobs will be so we manage expectations. The gas treatment plant modules cannot be built in Alaska. We don't have the fab yards to do that. So they will be built somewhere else. So what we've focused on is the compressor stations in particular and the modules that are associated with it can be built in Alaska, and they're truckable. And so that's a piece that we really need to focus on, that we have the workforce necessary to do that. The other piece is the construction jobs associated with the pipeline itself are going to be in Alaska, and you can train and man people to do that. And we've had a number of conversations with Commissioner Click on his workforce development program and trying to feed into that. But I think now that we have an execution plan, we can detail those numbers to him so that we can build what that looks like. So it's understanding where the jobs are, it's managing expectations, and it's doing it as early as you can.
If you mean follow up?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, on that point. You know, I mention that now because you're somewhat in the process, almost to the point, to where as we go into the next legislative session, with I know that everybody sitting at this table, highest concern is jobs for Alaskans and making sure we can do that, you know, whether there's statute change or whatever it's going to take to try and help provide for that. And I don't know what that could be, so I don't know if your legal analysis is looking at or whatever the case can be, but I know that I have no problem calling you directly and talking to you, and the co-chairs here I'm sure do on a regular basis. I know I do, and I certainly appreciate that, but I just want to make sure that Alaska's in a position to make sure we've got the highest opportunity possible to make sure those are jobs that are going to Alaska's companies, at least the Alaska portion.
Any other questions in the room? Anyone online have any additional questions? Would that butter you... are you at a place to
We are. We thank you for your time today and questions. It's an exciting point for us in the project. We look forward to seeing the results of open season. And if you want additional information, I've got the website there online. All this material is on our website. There's an immense amount of material on the website itself. I would encourage you to go visit it or have your staffers take a look at it. Thank you.
Yeah. This is Peggy Wilson, and I do have one question.
Wilson.
Thank you. I apologize. My question is, have you met, well, I'm sure you have, but I don't know to what degree, have you met with Labor and Workforce Development? I know you said you had talked with Click, but are we changing... is there anything that we need to change in what we're doing as far as some of the training that we're doing now that would help more of our people get jobs?
Representative, through the chair, we have had fairly extensive discussions with Commissioner Click, and we have met with most of the labor unions on a fairly regular basis. I think that the important thing is that we keep up to date and people understand where the jobs are. I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but we have an execution plan now, and this is detailed down in the crafts that are going to be used, when they're going to be used, so forth. So we're in a very good position to talk about where those jobs are going to be, when we're going to need them, and what those jobs may be. So we're in a position to continue to talk with Commissioner Click and the union trades themselves about that. And then that helps them dictate how they're going to do the training. I think the question they all have, which is not answerable right now, is when do we need these? You know, we put forward a schedule that's a success case schedule if everything falls together. And I've mentioned some of the issues outside of our control that are not resolved, those could impact the schedule itself.
Yeah.
And I think when we talk to them, that's what they become frustrated about. Well, when should we start this? We don't want to get behind.
Yes, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Chair, would a project like this, obviously, is a lot of labor. Would it be an open bidding process on this? Would there be project labor agreements on this project?
Representative Newman, through the chair, we're going to need as many workers as we can find, and there will be multiple project labor agreements. on this project is our anticipation.
I have one final question, and I understand you may not, and you probably won't answer this or can't answer this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I think since day one, we've all heard that there's only going to be one pipeline, that everyone's going to have to get together, and we're going to have to sing off the same sheet of music. Are there any conversations going on now between Exxon, TransCanada, and Denali? And if you want me to put the gavel down now, I will. But are those conversations going on? Can they be precipitated? I think we're all going, you're hiding that from me, aren't you? I think we all know there's not going to be two pipelines.
I'd be happy to answer that question, Mr. Chairman. I think it's a very, very important question, and I'm asked this almost at every meeting, and the question a lot of people ask is, when are the two projects going to come together? It's clear that there's not enough gas for two pipelines. There will only be one pipeline here. The state's in a dilemma right now. TransCanada is an AGIA licensee. The state is paying them their terms and conditions they must honor. My two owners, BP and ConocoPhillips, do not agree with the terms and conditions of AGIA. And I might add, either does Exxon. They have not signed on to those terms and conditions. So it is problematic for the two projects to come together to form one project. And, you know, I continue to kind of push and focus on, we need to come together as a project here in the state and resolve some of these issues and unravel some of the issues that exist in AGIA so that we can move forward together. It's compounded now from where it was 2 years ago. We have an extremely competitive gas market in North America that's been depressed. Demand is down. Alaska needs to get all parties together so that we can compete in that market. But there are issues that stand out there that are, you know, they're outside Denali's control to resolve. We've listed what they are. So those still exist out there. But there will only be one project. And it's our hope there will be one project. But there's some work that needs to be done in order for that to happen.
And this is the million-dollar question or billion-dollar question. Is AGIA standing in the way of this pipeline being built?
Mr. Chairman, it's my belief that some of the terms and conditions of AGIA are standing in the way of the pipeline being built, yes. That's my humble opinion.
I don't suppose you want to name those, do you? Just, Representative Cotto, do you have a question?
I do, and it's just like yours. TransCanada has indicated that they hold lots, if not all, of the First Nation permits that they received from the Crown for 40 years ago. And those permits would be impossible to get now. Is that a true statement?
Representative through the chair, let me talk about what I know. I won't comment on exactly what they said. I've talked to the high-level industry people in Canada. I've talked to the Minister of Energy, to the head of the EPA in Canada, to the chairman of the NEB. They have an open process for building a pipeline. There is no exclusive right for any party to build a pipeline in Canada. That is fact. Under NPA, TransCanada has that right under NPA, but there is a parallel process through the National Energy Board for any project to be built. And in fact, the Department of Natural Resources has set up a special office for Denali called the Major Projects Management Office. The NPA also reports into the Natural Resource NRCan. Is that Natural Resource Management? It's a department like the DNR here. So the process is there for both projects to move forward. We have had extensive conversations with stakeholders, Aboriginal groups up and down the pipeline route, and there are some of them that say no one has a permit to cross their lands. Some of the lands are what are called unsettled land claims. Unsettled means they haven't resolved it with the Crown, so they certainly haven't resolved it with anyone else.
So I think, for me, what I've taken away is, A, there's no exclusive right to build a pipeline in Canada. Our process is as valid as our competition's process. B, there are issues that exist out there for both projects to resolve to move the project forward in Canada.
Representative, I'm sure we all want to go home, so let's go
to it. I do too, but I think you really brought up some good subjects, Mr. Chair, as usual. You know, and Bud, you know, what's it going to take to bring this all together? And, you know, you can't fix a problem until you know what the problem is. You can't fix it. And if it's going to take the meeting of the minds of all companies, I think that's a good thing. And I don't know if you're willing to talk to us in private or in person or in public and say, you know, here's some of the issues that need to be resolved, you know, to try and bring both these large diameter pipeline proposals together. You know, again, we can't fix it till we know it's broke, and we're the people who fix it. And if one thing that's telling to me is if you're hesitant to talk about that publicly, maybe that's an indicator in itself.
Representative Newman, through the chair, I'm not hesitant to talk about it publicly. I think we know what the issues are. They're very clear. Some of them are on this slide right here that I've shown you. Open season is going to tell us in very clear terms what the conditions precedent are on the shipper's side in the event they decide to sign a precedent agreement. But if they sign a precedent agreement, they will have conditions precedent. It will tell you what those issues are that need to be resolved to move forward. They don't sign a precedent agreement, it's maybe tell even more. There are even bigger issues that exist. And we don't know what will happen in open season right now. But I don't think the issues are unfamiliar to us or unclear. I think we understand what the issues are.
And Bud, that was the reason for my question about the confidentiality. At some point, we're going to have to dig into this and fix this problem. Hopefully, the people at this table will be doing that. And if we don't know what they are, we certainly can't fix them. So that's why I'm encouraging Denali. I'll say the same to TransCanada. I'll say the same to everyone I get a chance to, that the sooner we can know what those conditions are, that they're not kept in confidential files, the sooner that we as a body and we as a government can start addressing those problems. So those are concerns I have about that confidentiality clause that FERC has. I know they do it to protect, but if we can get those waived and start working and roll our sleeves up sooner than later. And that was kind of my whole warning, my question about that confidentiality. If we have to sign confidentiality agreements, we've all done it before. So, any additional questions, comments? I'd like to thank everyone for attending. Thank you for coming today. It is my intention to ask your alleged counselor and LBNA to have an independent analysis done of the two open seasons that we have, so that we can maybe do a side-by-side comparison, so that at least we can know it was April, I think, when we heard our last presentation from TC. I would like to see some side-by-side pluses and minuses of all those. I think everyone in the legislature might like that. So the co-chair and I have passed notes back and forth, and it is our intention to try to have that analysis done in some form or fashion. With that, if there are no additional questions, my co-chair has given me back the gavel, and we will stand in adjournment. And once again, thanks, everyone, for their attendance.